Welcome to Season 2 of Cast a Blast Conversations, brought to you in part by Triumph Benefit Auctions. This week, we're joined by Marsha Brownlee, Program Manager for Artemis Sportswoman, a part of National Wildlife Federation. But before we get to Marsha, I need to take a moment to tell you about Triumph Benefit Auctions, owned and operated by friend of the show, Mark Dobe Dobersch. We've been talking about Dobe this entire season, and we're into the summer. We're starting to get past the corona. Everything's insane in 2020. Why not reach out to Dobe and work with him to make some good things happen this year? Schools, conservation orgs, churches, nonprofits, anyone looking to put out a top-tier event, Dobe is your guy. It helps to raise funds when you love the things you're raising funds for. So give him a call or text, 863-602-5921. By the way, I need to tell you guys we're using Zoom again this week, and if we have any Audacity users listening, I need a tutorial on how to clean up some of this audio. So you can still hear and understand everything, but bear with us as we're trying to figure out how to optimize this tool and produce cleaner sounds for your ears. Now, Marsha Brownlee is an educator by nature. After spending many years teaching kids and then teaching teachers, she made the jump into the conservation space. And if that sounds like quite the turn, you should hear her version. We chat about Artemis, how Marsha got to NWF, obstacles and opportunities in recruitment, not just for women, but for a whole bunch of different groups, who she's following, her most memorable outdoor experiences, and, of course, pineapples on pizza. With that, Marsha Brownlee of Artemis Sportswoman is coming up right now. Okay, Marsha, thank you for joining us today. Who is Marsha Brownlee?
Who is Marsha Brownlee? I am a hunter and an angler, adult onset hunter-angler. I am a current Montanan. I grew up in Michigan, lived in Massachusetts for 7 years, 2 years in Colorado, and have been in Montana for 10 years and don't plan on leaving. I am an educator and a naturalist and a cook. I wouldn't say chef. A cook. I am a gardener. I am a dog owner. I am a daughter. I am a sister. I think that about wraps it up for...
Did you say Artemis? Did you talk about Artemis? I mean, did you mention Artemis?
I didn't. I said I'm a hunter-angler. Okay. I'm a program manager for Artemis.
I screwed that all up, didn't I? How do you feel? No. Okay. Before we get, did you say you're a dog owner?
I did.
What kind of dog do you have?
I have a 12-year-old Dutch Shepherd. Is the best guess at the breed dog. She's got a brindle coat and bought her at the Humane Society when I was in Colorado.
Those are gigantic dogs, right?
She's about 75 pounds.
Okay.
Just good size.
Before we get into some questions, I have to ask what I call the baseline questions, and these establish your relevancy to our audience. So you're either going to be in or you're going to be out after these couple of questions. And the first one is, does pineapple go on a pizza?
That's tough. So I have to give a long answer. I'm a long answer person. I lived in Japan for a year and they put shrimp and corn on their pizza, which feel is worse than pineapple. So if I had to choose pineapple, yes, but normally no.
Okay. Can I ask a weird question just off to the side? My picture of Montana is that you guys don't have pizza. Everything's like a barbecue joint. Like, do you guys have pizza places there?
We do have pizza.
Can you get good pizza in Montana with pineapple on it?
I've never gotten pineapple on a pizza in Montana, but I do believe it's possible. And yes, you can get good pizza, and I can get the best pizza in town here in Missoula.
What? Are you a peanut butter person?
I am a peanut butter person.
Go ahead and tell them what's your Instagram.
My Instagram handle is peanut butter and mangoes.
Okay. So what type of peanut butter and what brand of peanut butter? Are you crunchy creamy? Are you an all natural? Are you, and what brand?
Yeah. So I am a smooth, all natural, no brand preference.
Brand agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That we're getting a lot of those this season. And I think that's wrong. I think Peter Pan is the right brand, but as long as it's not crunchy. If it's crunchy, we were going to have to interview and be done.
Yep.
And last but not least, you're going on a fishing trip. You're going on a hunting trip. What is the snack that's in your bag?
Well, it's different for each. If I'm fishing, then it's probably, if I'm like boat fishing, it's chips. It's salt and vinegar chips for sure. But if I'm anywhere in the field with a backpack, then it's peanut butter and jelly. No joke. Or cheese. I like cheese.
Okay. I'm sorry. No one else has ever gotten this question because no one else has had this affinity for peanut butter where it entered their Instagram handle. But what jelly do you go with on a peanut butter jelly?
My preferences are either, well, I have three. Blueberry. I like blueberry jam. I'm a jam person. Strawberry. And then I'm from Michigan, which has sour cherry jam. And that's really good too.
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm making a note about that because that's something I'll have to check out. I've never heard of such a thing.
Yep. It's good.
No blackberry, no grape.
No grape.
Okay.
Do grape. I will do blackberry on occasion.
Well, it was good to talk to you, Marcia. Thank you for stopping by. We will have to cancel you now. So
Which one threw me under the bus there? Was it the grape?
Yeah. So I personally, we have three hosts on our Tuesday show and they are accepting of strawberry as a jelly choice. I am not. I love strawberry jelly on biscuits or something, but not on a peanut butter jelly sandwich. That's sacrilegious. So you talked about a couple of things and you went by them pretty quick. You said you're an adult onset hunter. How do you feel about that term? Because I know that term's gotten a little bit of a backlash lately. So
yeah. So I personally don't have any preference for or against the term. I understand. I understand why people don't necessarily like it. I sometimes fall back on it as just the quickest way to describe myself. Otherwise it's a long story.
I get it. And you said you're a naturalist. Mm-hmm. Is that like by training, by hobby, by like, what do you mean by that?
By hobby. So okay. I think when I dive into that more closely, it has a lot to do with my identity as an educator. I was a nature-based educator. And so part of that was spending time outside with kids and adults and just exploring the natural world.
Okay. And let's talk about that for just a second, because something fascinating I found out about you today is that you went to Harvard for grad school.
Harvard Graduate School of Education, not to be confused with Harvard University, but.
Right. But it's still in Cambridge.
Yep.
Still in Massachusetts or wherever, because I said Boston and you corrected very quickly that it was Cambridge.
Yes.
I think that's fascinating. And you went to Michigan State, go Spartans.
Yep. Okay. Go Spartans.
Are you a football fan?
I don't follow a team religiously, but I do enjoy watching the games on TV. I don't like crowds, so live games aren't my thing.
Okay. I agree with that. I enjoy watching football on TV, but not in person. Sure. All right. Let's talk before we talk about you, let's talk about Artemis Sportswoman. You are the program director for that. Is that the right term?
Program manager.
Program manager. And this is from National Wildlife Federation. So can you just kind of explain to our audience what Artemis Sportswoman is?
You bet. So Artemis Sportswoman is an initiative of the National Wildlife Federation. We started in 2017. So we are a few years old now. I think we just celebrated our third birthday. We started in the West as an organization to engage women hunters and anglers in conservation advocacy. And we've since expanded nationally as of February this year, which is super exciting. Our focus, well, the reason Artemis was found as an initiative in the first place is really twofold. One, to aid in the R3 efforts of recruiting, retaining, and reactivating sportswomen and helping form a community of women mentors and mentees and connecting them to each other. But then secondly, in the world of conservation, there was a lack of a sportswoman's voice, and that voice can really be effective when we're looking to tell stories and change minds of our legislators and advocacy issues. And so our goal there is to really support them to step up to the microphone.
One of the things I looked when I was poking around on your site is you have kind of three tenets. Am I saying that right? Is that what you guys call them or not? But one's public lands, one's iconic species, and one's leadership development. Mm-hmm. Where are you guys at on public lands? Like, can you talk about that a little bit? Because and let me preface it with this. In Florida, we get into some internal or some side some discussions on the side with folks like BHA, because mm-hmm. for us, public lands are state lands. Mm-hmm. And when you think nationally, you think public lands, you're talking like BLM land or federal lands. And so can you talk about Artemis on public lands and where that goes? And then we'll go through iconic species and leadership development.
Yeah, so Artemis is part of the Public Lands team on the National Wildlife Federation. So we work directly with them. We work both on the national level and on the state level. I think one of the great things about the structure of the National Wildlife Federation is that they have state affiliates that come together to determine what the national resolutions and strategic focus is. And so those are Montana Wildlife Federation, Georgia Wildlife Federation, you know, there's all over the country. And we partner really closely with them to do work locally. So when I'm talking about public lands, I'm talking about both federal public lands and state public lands, you know, even city public lands. And so we work to advocate to maintain access and habitat quality on those public lands. The National Wildlife Federation and Artemis believes in the multi-use of public lands, and that's specifically, or most broadly, for our federal public lands. You know, those lands are multi-use and we fully support that, but we prioritize maintaining the critical habitat and the conservation focus in those management plans.
Okay. No, that was a good answer. And I am a big fan of NWF personally. I've done a lot of work with Vanishing Paradise and those folks, and I've done some of the fly-ins with NWF and DC. I kind of already knew that they saw both sides of that coin, but I wanted to hear you verbalize it because I think that's an important distinction, especially down here, that sometimes we think when we hear public lands, we think, oh, they only care about federal lands. And for us, it's a very different conversation talking federally than it is in Montana or in Colorado or in.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think as far as the conservation focus that we've had over the last couple of years, the Land and Water Conservation Fund is a perfect example of that. Like that benefits federal and state lands, and Artemis has done a lot of work to make sure that that is prioritized.
Yeah, I think that's touched every county in the country.
Yep.
I think every county in the United States has a LWCF project in it. So. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those, sorry.
No,
a lot of those are state-based too, because they provide matching funds for state.
Or even for us, municipality. Like there's a lot of like cities or counties that have a park or whatever that was built with LWCF money. Mm-hmm. Explain the iconic species portion of Artemis to me.
Yeah. So keeping in mind that Artemis was launched in the West. So when we were founded, our work was prioritized in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico. And two of the iconic species in the West are the mule deer and the cutthroat trout. And so in order to target our conservation goals, we focus on those species to best make the most impact in the work that we were doing. And so, you know, for example, for the mule deer, that meant doing a lot of work around sage grouse habitat, with the sage grouse being an indicator species about the quality of the habitat. And so a whole save the bird, save the herd mentality with mule deer. And then with cutthroat trout, you know, water quality issues are big in the West, and also focusing on habitat restoration. So we've done a lot of beaver work in doing research and riparian areas about the number of beaver around there and just the things that they do to improve water quality for cutthroat trout.
And the beaver improves water quality for cutthroat trout?
It does, yes.
How does that work?
So the beaver dams, particularly in the West, so I'll speak on Montana because that's where we've done most of the work. When you're talking about high elevation beaver dams, that allows the water system to retain water for longer in the season. Without the dams, it kind of just goes straight from the mountain all the way down to the valley. And so we have huge flooding issues. The water gets really low really quickly, so it gets really hot. And cutthroat trout do not like hot water. So with beavers, the landscape, then, you know, they create more pools and ponds and the dams that they create back the water up. So the land holds onto the water longer. It's a slower drain over the course of the summer, keeps the water colder, which helps the cutthroat trout combat other invasive fish species.
Wow. Okay. I had no idea about that. And I have heard the sage grouse thing before, but can you give me a quick overview on that? How sage grouse as an indicator work to help mule deer?
Yeah. So sage grouse, their mating grounds are called leks. and they return to the same place every year in the sage grouse habitat, which is sagebrush throughout the West here, is under threat for a variety of reasons. Some of its development, some of its invasive species for plants and weeds. It's under threat. And as the quality of the habitat decreases, the number of sage grouse on the habitat decreases. And so it's the idea, if the sage grouse is an indicator species, if we can keep tabs on their numbers and make the quality of the habitat enough to sustain their population, we're improving the entire ecosystem of the sagebrush habitat. And so if the bird has a quality habitat, so does the deer.
Does that make sense? It makes complete sense. You explained that really well. Does Artemis, so say somebody's listening to this and we're going to talk more about your story and weave the Artemis story through that, but does Artemis do memberships? Like, how can someone get involved with Artemis?
So we do free memberships. People are encouraged to visit our website, which is artemis.nwf.org, and there's a join us button, and that indicates an interest in getting involved. And so what that does is it puts you on our newsletter. We'll send you updates both on what's happening in the sportswomen's community and what's happening in the conservation community. But it also enables us to pinpoint you geographically. So if there's specific conservation issues in your area that need attention, we can reach out to you directly. If there are communities, sportswomen communities in your area doing cool things, we can connect them to you directly. It's free. We do not charge for membership.
Okay. How about, can you give us a little backstory on kind of the founders, how Artemis was created? Because I thought that was pretty neat as I was piecing it together, doing some research for this. Can you give us a little backstory on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So my boss at the National Wildlife Federation is a man named Aaron Kindle, who's the director of sporting advocacy for the National Wildlife Federation. And he really was the person to think that, you know, to pinpoint and highlight this gap of the sportswoman's voice in conservation advocacy and how important that could be. He very quickly realized that he wasn't the person to create the program and be its voice. So he did research, he hired Jess Johnson, who is one of our co-founders, to be the first program manager. And then together they did a lot of research to identify strong women hunters and anglers and conservationists across the West, who then came together for a strategic planning session to really flesh out who is Artemis, what are the goals of Artemis, and what is, what's our identity? How are we going to push this forward? And so to start with, that was 8 women from across the West.
And then you've been there how long?
I've been here 2 years.
Okay. And before that, you were an educator for a long period of time.
Yes. So I came directly to Artemis as the executive director of a nonprofit preschool. And okay. I had that. And before that, I was a teacher in the classroom.
So let's talk about you for a minute. How did you get there?
Right.
Yeah.
It's not a direct line.
Right. So if I'm talking about someone that you went to school, then you went to Massachusetts for grad school, you focused on education. You said you're an adult onset hunter. So how did you get to where you're at?
Yeah.
Is that a story?
Yes. Yes. I'll try and tell it succinctly. I got a master's in education. And I went from there to, interestingly, my master's in education is actually in adult education. But immediately after graduation, I found myself in a preschool teaching nature-based education to preschool students. And so that was really focused on using the natural world as a learning space and helping them foster that connection to nature, which has, as everybody who is connected to nature knows, has long-term benefits, cognitively, emotionally, socially. It's just really unending. So I focused on that in Colorado for 2 years and then moved to Missoula and continued to teach in the classroom at a nature-based preschool. And then at that point decided that I wanted to be in charge. So I applied for a director position and there learned a lot about mentoring teachers, about talking to families and what it is like to run a nonprofit. So when I moved to Montana, I started fly fishing because you're supposed to. It's a requirement. And then, so that was about 11 years ago now. And then 5 or 6 years ago, I asked my dad to take me to the shooting range. He is currently the range master at a rifle range here in Montana. And my mom was sick. She was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And my dad and I were obviously going through a pretty difficult time taking care of her. But like most people, we're better when we're doing something together, as opposed to just struggling together. So I wanted us to do something fun. So I asked him to teach me how to shoot. And as a preschool teacher, one of the books that every teacher knows is If You Give a Moose a Muffin. You know that book? And so
we did If You Gave a Mouse a Cookie.
That was my son's
favorite. So yes, we did that one.
So you like this. I said immediately after I had a rifle in my hand, if you give a naturalist a gun, she's going to want to take it to hunt. So I did. I had a boyfriend in my life at the time who was an avid hunter. And he mentored me the first year of my hunting experience, and the rest is history. And so hunting changed my life. It changed my connection to the natural world. It changed my understanding of the natural world. It changed my priorities. And so a few years after that, I started a business here in Montana with a close friend of mine called Venery. I'm no longer a partner in it, although the company is still doing good work. And that company's goal was to teach women how to hunt and to create that community locally. And from there, I saw the Artemis position, and my eyes got all starry, and I applied and was lucky enough to get it.
Well, because you saw an opportunity probably at a larger, on a larger scope, right? You were able to affect more people through that.
Able to affect more people through that program for sure. Also, really at a point in my life where I was ready to dig into the front lines of conservation. I know I always approached my job as an educator, as, you know, connect, like one of my favorite quotes as an educator is from David Sobel. And that quote is, you have to teach somebody to love something first before you can ask them to save it. And so I really viewed my role as a nature educator was to connect kids to that natural world so much so that they would love it. And therefore, when they grew up, they would protect it. And that was a real long-term perspective. And I was great with that for 15 years. But it felt more urgent as I became an adult and as I became a hunter and wanted to get involved a little bit more directly.
We've been tossing this quote around quite a bit down here lately in a lot of conversations, and it's from Baba Dayum, and it's, we can serve only what we love, love only what we understand, and understand only what we've been taught. And it goes very much in line with that quote. So you're an adult onset hunter. Sounds like you're an adult onset fisherman too.
Yeah. I mean, I fished when I was a kid, a lot of spin fishing for catfish and trout and pool and like, you know, those little man-made pools. We would fish recreationally when I would go on vacation, but it wasn't a part of my life and it certainly wasn't a part of my identity.
You would go fishing, but you were not a fisher person.
We would fish while we were camping.
Gotcha. So now that you, how long, 5 years? Is that how long you've been doing that stuff? 7 years?
So I've been, I always think like for fly fishing, I mean, chronologically, you could say it's been about 10 years, but I think if you were to like crunch all of the days that I've actually been on the water down into one consecutive, it's not that long. But yeah, I started fishing about 10 years ago and then fishing about 5.
So what are some of the experiences that you've had that like stick out in your mind since you started doing that?
There's a lot I'm like going through my brain trying to land on one.
You don't have to land on one.
I can, are you sure?
I'm sure.
So I'll start with fishing. You know, I think for fishing and hunting, like the first fish you catch is always the most exciting. And so there are two like so this is fly fishing. I'm talking about fly fishing for trout in Montana streams and rivers. And the first, like, I feel like for the first 3 years, all of the fish that I caught were accidental. You know, I would go to back cast and hello, there's a fish there, but it wasn't anything I did intentionally or on purpose. So the first intentional fish that I caught was in this little, it was a creek in the middle of a meadow, so I could back cast with abandon because I wasn't worried about getting snagged. And I caught this rainbow trout who I swear to God was probably 4 inches long, but I hunted that fish intentionally. There's a picture of me squeezing the poor thing. I was really, really pleased with that fish. And then my father is a very generous man, and I'm lucky enough to be his adventure buddy. And we went recently about this time last year, we went fishing for halibut and salmon off the coast of Alaska. And that was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. And I caught some beautiful fish, but the one that I remember most was a 109-pound halibut. And getting that up on the boat with me kind of screaming at this rod, bent over, "You are mine!" to get over the deck. That was lovely. I'm still eating him. He's delicious.
And what about from a hunting side?
From a hunting side, it's hard to narrow down. I'll pick two. So I think one of my favorite hunts was an antelope hunt that I went on. So I feel like each species requires a few years for me to figure out how to be successful in the field. And one of the first species I tried to hunt is antelope up here in eastern Montana on that sagebrush land. It's just a really fun landscape to hunt. And it was a animal that I wouldn't say taught myself to hunt, because I did have a lot of help along the way, but it was one that I didn't go out in the field with mentors. I went out in the field with other women hunters who were learning just as I was. And so that was a really fun collaborative learning experience. Each year we would get a little bit closer to harvesting an animal. And then on our third year out, I shot an antelope, and it was just a wonderful experience where you walked up this coulee shortly after sunrise and sat there because we could see the antelope, but the sun was behind them, so it was kind of difficult to identify. And they were a little bit far away, so we just waited as they grazed near us. So we were able to watch them for a good 45 minutes. And I think just the whole experience of watching them for that long and then deciding, you know, kind of choosing an animal to shoot. I was really surprised by, you know, everybody knows when you're hunting, maybe not everybody, but the adrenaline flows, right? Like there's excitement and you're on point and the adrenaline is rushing. And I'd felt that before, but it was always from start to finish that the adrenaline had been present. And this one, you know, I sat still for 45 minutes. And so I was calm. I was just watching. But when I decided to shoot, when I was like, okay, they're close enough, I can see them. That animal is giving me a great broadside. I'm going to shoot that one. The adrenaline flooded my body and I didn't move. I just thought that was an interesting experience. And it was a good shot. She fell pretty close to where she was standing, and it was just really fun. And I got to share it with two of my good friends. So that antelope hunt, and then seeing those animals up close. I mean, that's one thing too, is, you know, we have the privilege of touching these animals and just seeing them up close, and they're beautiful. An antelope, for people who aren't familiar with that animal, they have giant eyes because, you know, that's one of their survival traits is distance viewing, and their eyes are huge and they're just beautiful, and their fur is hollow because they're super fast and it's an incredible thing to be that close to an animal.
That's one. You said that's one. Two.
Yeah. And when I started hunting, my first animal that I harvested was a white-tailed deer. And after hunting for a couple of years, my dad asked me if I wanted to go bear hunting with him. And I said, no, I don't think I'm ready for that. And then a month later, he asked again. And I said, no, I don't think I'm ready for that. And a month later, he asked again. And so I was like, okay, this is important to you and you don't want to go alone. So yes, I will go bear hunting with you. And now it's a tradition for him, for the two of us. We go for a week every spring. And our second year bear hunting, I harvested a bear, and it was this beautiful, beautiful cinnamon bear, huge boar that I harvested in Idaho. And that was just a really powerful experience as well. They're just a powerful animal, and watching him walk into my field of view, it was just a really powerful and really emotional experience. And I think that to me was when I realized that hunting was a lifelong thing for me. Because as I mentioned, you know, I started hunting in line with my mom's diagnosis with Alzheimer's. And so my journey learning to be a hunter and her decline happened in tangent, very close together. And becoming a hunter was a very healing thing for me in that moment. And just what it allowed me to think about and process in the field. And I shot that bear, and a week later, my mom died. And so obviously both of those are very emotional experiences. And to me, they are, they're intricately tied together in complicated ways. But in that moment in the woods with that bear, it was just a powerful experience that I struggle to put into words. But that's definitely one of my most memorable hunts.
I wish people could see your face as you're telling it, because you can see the emotion on your face as you're talking about it. Like you could tell how powerful and important it is to you. Mm-hmm. Do you waterfowl hunt at all? Just curious.
So I have not hunted myself, but two of my experiences in the beginning of my journey as a hunter was accompanying a friend on a duck hunt and on a snow goose hunt. And the snow goose hunt in particular was a truly magical experience.
Did you guys have them dump in like the big tornado of them?
Yes. And then they're in the, like we were in the middle of a field surrounded by thousands and thousands and thousands of snow geese, and they are loud. And it was just amazing. Yeah.
Nature's pretty cool. So what, tell me about this. This is a weird question for me to ask, because I'm a white guy participating in this world a little bit. What are the challenges you see on the landscape for women in conservation, women in hunting? Maybe it's through the work you do with Artemis. Maybe it's some of the stuff you saw that spurred you to seek out an organization like Artemis, but can mm-hmm. you talk about kind of what you see there? And you've got the floor, like take that wherever you
want. Yeah. So I'll focus on two things, because again, I think, and I'll focus on my own experience and drawing, of course, on my experience as the Artemis program manager too, but I think the challenges are very personal. But two things that I've witnessed. One is community. The R3 work that's done has sort of nailed recruitment. There are some amazing recruitment programs going on across the country, and they're doing them well, and they're doing them with a lot of intention. But what's not there yet for women is community, because you know, it's easy to find a person to mentor. It can be easy to find a person to mentor you in the field. You know, if you ask a hunter, "Will you take me out?" They'll say yes more often than not, because they're as excited to get new people in the field as we are. So, but it's really difficult to transition from that mentoring role to the hunt camp buddy role. For obvious reasons, you know, not every mentor should be expected to then become best friends with their mentee. That's not reasonable. But women are having a hard time finding those communities to help make hunting a part of their lifestyle. We on the Artemis podcast, we talked to a close friend of mine about reactivation, and she actually is from Florida, started hunting. Bow hunting in Florida 20, 25 years ago as an adult, and then moved to Minnesota. And, you know, she asked a family that she knows who hunts if she could join their hunt camp. And they said, "You can come during the day, but not overnight." And then moving to Montana, the same thing. You say, like, having to be very outgoing and somewhat audacious in approaching probably men and saying, "Hey, can I be a part of your hunting community?" And that's not easy to do for a lot of different reasons. And so identifying other women that you can form those relationships with is difficult. A, because their existence isn't very obvious. And so a lot of times there's trouble identifying who could be a potential friend, and especially in your geographical location, and then the self-initiative necessary to build that relationship. So that's the role that Artemis really hopes to play too, is focusing on building these communities on the ground so sportswomen can develop relationships with themselves, and you can have that group of people that you can go to hunt camp with. And that's difficult because it's not something that you can solve with a program. It's a culture, and it's relationships. But I definitely think that's a challenge right now in the landscape. And then the other thing I see is, and this is true for conservation and hunting and fishing, and it's getting better, but it's the visibility and the connections to be able to tell our stories on a bigger level. Because we're not...
Say that again. Repeat that again. You cut out just a little bit. I want to get that. Say that again.
It's the visibility and the connections to be able to tell our story on a bigger level. Because if you ask me, I mean, I could list 50 women hunters and anglers who are absolutely amazing. And not one of them has ever told their story publicly. And I know, and I'm sure that's true for men as well. But the difference is there are more outlets willing to tell more stories for a certain type of hunter than there are for others. And so again, that's part of our goal, is to really give women who don't normally have the microphone, and in conjunction with that, give them the confidence to take it. You know, as I mentioned, the Artemis podcast, it surprises me how, A, nobody's asked these women to be on a podcast before. B, they're usually very nervous. And C, they always caveat their knowledge and their experience. And I think you need to look past that caveat to see the knowledge and experience for what it is, and help them see it for what it is too.
And the knowledge and experience, but also the perspective. We all have different perspectives. There's a lot of talk on the landscape right now. I don't even want to go down that road, but we all get wrapped up in identities, and really we are all individual people. So mm-hmm. The fact that you're not quote unquote an expert or whatever in that particular field doesn't really matter, because your perspective is uniquely yours. And I think mm-hmm. the ability to be able to listen to other people's perspectives and share those, I think it adds a lot of weight and a lot of value to conversations that aren't being had. I think far mm-hmm. too often we seek out the same perspective that we share because we identify with it, and it ends up with almost like an echo chamber. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way, but we need better perspectives or different perspectives on the landscape. Is that mm-hmm. fair?
It's absolutely fair. And I think, it's because I think everybody has good intentions about sharing stories. I think we all acknowledge that that's important. But it is very easy to get stuck in a cycle of what's easy. Those connections are really important, because the people holding the biggest microphone don't know the same people that I know. And so they're more likely to go to the people that they know. It's just human nature. It makes sense. And in order to break out of that pattern, it has to be really intentional.
Very intentional. It's something we talked about off air a little bit. I've struggled with when I find looking for someone for an interview, the easiest thing for me to do is go to the people that I already know or the connections I already have. And frankly, most of those are men. So it's sometimes it's uncomfortable to reach out to folks you don't know in the space, and you have to broker. It's an awkward conversation you go through the first time, but yeah. I think it's the right thing to do. We should all be doing a better job of that.
Yeah. And I think if it's approached from a place of authenticity and sincerely wanting to hear the person's story, then that's the way it's got to be for now.
You talked about R3. You've mentioned it several times. Mm-hmm. And it's something we're super passionate about, and we talk about it a lot on our Tuesday podcast. And you can answer this from how whatever perspective you want. It can be about R3 with women, R3 with minorities as a whole. It can be R3 just in general. But what are we doing right? And then where are our opportunities for improvement?
Mm-hmm. What we're doing right is that we're asking the questions and we're funding it. You know, I think that's what it's definitely a priority in the hunting community for a lot of different reasons. There's energy there. The questions that we're asking are evolving. And you know, you have great organizations like the Council to Advance the Hunting and Shooting Sports that's working as a great resource for nonprofit organizations and state agencies in their R3 work and really building those connections. And then we have the Pittman-Robertson Modernization Act that was passed that allows money raised from excise taxes to be used towards outreach and marketing to new audiences in hunting. And so we're funding it, which is great. I mean, I think those are things we're all doing really well. We're recognizing the importance of including more stories. We're recognizing the importance of different types of environments for different types of learners. So those are the things we're doing right. And I think if we're looking for areas of improvement, again, I think it's needing to look past that recruitment stage into the retention and reactivation stage. I do think a lot of the focus is still on recruitment, and obviously that's where you need to start. But I think we're ready to move past that and to do more research into what is effective in those areas. And I also think when you talk about retention and reactivation, it gets a lot more complicated, because with women in particular, when you're talking about retention and reactivation, a lot of times you're talking about how women prioritize their time, the support that we have at home to be able to prioritize those time. And there's just a lot of internal and external factors that state agencies can't help with. But telling more stories can help with. And creating spaces for women to talk about it, and for people of color to talk about it, and for LGBT community, LGBTQ hunters and anglers to talk about it, and to form those communities can help with that.
When you talk about time there, forgive me if this sounds like a terrible, like a
There's
macho
no such
question
thing
or anything.
As a bad question.
No, it might. But are you talking about the idea that in a traditional female role, they have the kids, the house, those kind of responsibilities on them? So generally the husband's more thought of as the guy that's going to go out and do the hunting. So the woman is having, like, am I oversimplifying that or?
No, I think that's a part of it. But I also think it's bigger than that. Because I think how women identify their leisure time is different than typically how men identify their leisure time. And so, yeah, I think, you know, women tend to balance more of the home duties when there are kids involved. The reasons behind that are very complicated and very dependent on the dynamics in the family. But we're less likely to say, honey, I'm going to go away for the weekend on a frequent basis. We're less likely to spend money on our hobbies as opposed to spending money on our family. And I think, you know, one thing I've learned personally as a woman hunter is how is the mindset that I bring to different situations. For example, the way I interact in a hunting group where I am the only woman under 60, the only woman and the only person under 60, is different than the way I interact in a group of women hunters who are all, you know, 25 to 45. And I think that's true for everybody. We bring different parts of ourselves to different dynamics, for better and for worse. And the best thing to do is put yourself in different environments and just observe how you react, because being aware of it is the first step. And so I think I think the same is true for time. Women approach it differently, and part of that is conscious and part of it is unconscious. So let's take a look at how we're defining our leisure. Let's take a look at what we're prioritizing and why, and really think about it in conjunction with our community.
This kind of ties into something you said a minute ago, but What voices do you listen to? And I'm not talking necessarily podcast specific. It could be writers, it could be videos, it could be it could be anyone. But what voices do you listen to? Who's talking to Marsha that you look to for, hey, I like what they're doing. I like kind of their perspective on this. And then I'd also like to pivot that question and say, who are you listening to that you think more people should be listening to? So maybe right. Some of those rated voices on the landscape that aren't getting the same, for lack of a better term, the same run that your mainstream voices are.
Yeah, absolutely. So who am I listening to? I'm going to approach this one from two directions. One is personally, Artemis now has over 40 volunteers associated with the organization. And all of those women are so amazing and so committed to creating a community of women hunters and anglers and to conservation that I get a lot of inspiration from each of them. So that's my personal network, right? Because I always have to look there first. But if I look outside of that, I think I get a lot of information from organizations like the National Wildlife Federation, since I've started to work for them. My respect for the work that they do and the way that they approach it and the people that carry it out has just grown significantly. Now, I mentioned earlier that they with public lands, they have a multi-use philosophy. And they do really good work balancing the huge umbrella of the National Wildlife Federation with the affiliates from across the country. And I just really have a lot of respect for their approach to conservation and a lot of trust for the information that they put out there. And then that filters down to their affiliates. You know, for me personally, the Montana Wildlife Federation is an organization that I have a lot of respect for and turn to them for my conservation information. I think April Vokey is an absolute wonderful resource for women, for anglers, period. For women anglers, I think she's great to follow. I recommend her. I love Randy Newberg. Again, I think his approach to conservation and his life philosophy is very admirable, and I really enjoy listening to him.
What about the underrated side?
The underrated side. Okay, here we go. I've been thinking a lot lately about the both the Black voices and the people of color voices and the LGBTQ voices that in the hunting and fishing world that should get more visibility and airtime than they do. And so for me, that's Brown Girl Outdoors on Instagram. And we do most of our work on Instagram, so I'm focusing there. But Brown Girl Outdoors is a great site. Chris Hill, her Instagram site is Miss Chris Hill. I've had the pleasure of working with her on a couple of Artemis projects, and she's an Artemis ambassador and an experienced and knowledgeable angler, and she's an advocate with Sierra Club. She works for them. She's great. All right. Also on Instagram, there's Brown Folks Fishing. And that's a great site with a lot of different ambassadors. So it will connect you to just a broad range of amazing voices, including Awkward Angler, which is an Instagram handle for Erica Nelson. And then another one for Faith Briggs. Those are both just amazing women to follow. And then there's Numu Wanderer, which is a Instagram profile for Autumn Harry, which is, again, just a really great voice to follow. And then, you know, June is Pride Month. And I had the pleasure of recording a podcast yesterday with Sarah Keller and Taylor Morton, who recently started a Instagram site called Queers in Camo, designed to be a place where LGBTQ identifying hunters and anglers can come to build community. And this, they're going to have a happy hour to celebrate Pride Month. So if you log on there and start following them, you'll be able to participate in that. And then on Facebook, there's a great Facebook group called Hunters Like You that was pulled together by Crystal Egley. And that's a really nice community resource as well.
Sorry, I'm making notes.
Please do. And I could go on, but I also want to make sure that I don't overwhelm people.
No, I think that was a pretty succinct, honestly, a good list too. So is there anything we didn't talk about that you want to talk about? Is there anything you want to tell people in the Southeast, in Florida,
Yes. So as I mentioned, we recently opened up ambassador applications to women across the country. And I'm very excited that we now have boots on the ground in Georgia, and we'll soon have boots on the ground in Florida. So if you are interested in keeping tabs on that, then you can definitely either join us on our newsletter, which again is artemis.nwf.org, or you can follow us on social media. We are on Instagram. Our handle is at Artemis Sportswoman, and then we are also on Facebook, same name.
Why Artemis? I feel like I should know this. Is that a Greek goddess? Greek? Is it Greek?
She's the Greek goddess of nature and hunting.
Okay. Great name.
Yeah.
Great name.
The history behind that, which I always love a little, I mean, obviously it's very fitting for what we're hoping to do, because she was, not only was Artemis a hunter, but she was also a caretaker of the natural world, which is the goal of Artemis. You know, we're hunters and anglers, and we're also conservationists. We take it upon ourselves to take care of the natural world. But another, I guess, pro to the name was that you can't make an acronym out of it.
Oh, that's funny.
Yep.
That's funny. It has to always be Artemis.
Yep. There are so many acronyms in the world.
That's the truth. That's funny. Yep. So tell folks where they can, I think you just gave us the Instagram handle, but where can they find, do you want them to follow you on Instagram?
Yeah.
Okay. Where can folks find you on Instagram? Where can folks find Artemis? Where can they go get more information on any of this stuff?
Yes. Yes. You can follow us on Instagram. We do a lot of our outreach via social media. Because people tend to go there first for information. So we're on Instagram at Artemis Sportswoman. We're on Facebook, again, Artemis Sportswoman. We actually, since we just started a Facebook group for our podcast, which is Artemis Podcast. And that is literally like a week old. And it's fun to engage with people in that new way.
We have one of those, and it's the darkest place on the internet. Going to tell you, it's a strange, strange world there. Where, if folks want to find you, Marsha, where could they find you?
At Peanut Butter and Mangoes.
Peanut Butter and Mangoes on Instagram.
Yes. And wow. I warn you, you'll see a lot of pictures of my dog.
Well, you'd fit right in then. Marsha, thank you so much for what you're doing with Artemis and for spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much to Marsha for joining us, giving us so much of her time. Make sure you share Artemis with someone in your sphere of influence. I'm encouraging Emily to sign up as a member today. If you've enjoyed this podcast, would you consider a couple of things? One, share it with a friend you think would find it informative, entertaining, or whatever. And two, would you leave us a review on iTunes? As an independent podcast, we don't rely on big money ads or networks to produce more clicks. We're looking for authentic engagement. A huge part of that relies on you guys helping us out with things like shares, and reviews. We hope everyone has a great weekend, and we'll see y'all next week.